a prescription drug when she got pregnant with me. The drug was Paracetco. As a result, I have hyperempathy syndrome. He took that in with no sign of how he felt about it. He sat up and looked at me with great curiosity, as though he hoped to see some sign of my hyperempathy on my face or body. "You feel other people's pain?" he asked. "I share other people's pain and pleasure," I said. "There hasn't been much pleasure to share lately, except with you." "Do you share bleeding?" "No more. I did when I was little. But you... I saw you kill a man." "Yes?" I shook my head, remembering what he had seen. "I had to, or he would have killed me. I know that. It's just that... I'm surprised you were able to do it." "I told you, I had to." He shook his head. "I've read about the syndrome, of course, although I've never seen a case. I remember thinking that it might not be so bad a thing if most people had to endure all the pain they caused. Not doctors or medical people, of course, but most people." "Bad idea," I said. "I'm not sure. Take my word for it, bad, bad idea. Self-defense shouldn't have to be an agony, or a killing, or both. I could be crippled by the pain of a wounded person. I'm a very good shot because I've never felt that I could afford just to wound someone. Also..." I stopped, looked past him for a moment, and drew a deep breath, then focused on him again. "The worst of it is, if you got hurt, I might not be able to help you. I might be as crippled by your injury, by your pain, I mean, as you are." "I suspect you'd find a way." He smiled a little. "Don't suspect that, Bankole." I stopped and hunted for words that would make him understand. "I'm not looking for compliments or even reassurance. I want you to understand. If you broke your leg badly, if you were shot, if anything serious or disabling happened to you, I might be disabled too. You must know how disabling real pain can be." "Yes." "I know a little about you too." "No, don't tell me again that you aren't fishing for compliments. I know. Let's go back to camp. I've got some pain medications in my bag. I'll teach you how and when to use them on me or whoever needs them. If you can just hold on and be yourself long enough to use them, you can do whatever else may be necessary."
"Okay. So, do you still want to marry me?"
It surprised me how much I didn't want to ask the question. I knew he still wanted me, yet there I was, asking him, almost begging him to say it. I needed to hear it. He laughed, big, full laughter that sounded so real. I couldn't take offense. "I have to remember this," he said. "Do you imagine for a minute, girl, that I would let you get away?"
Chapter 23. Your teachers are all around you. All that you perceive, all that you experience, all that is given to you or taken from you, all that you love or hate, need or fear, will teach you, if you will learn. God is your first and your last teacher. God is your harshest teacher, subtle, demanding. Learn or die. Earthseed, The Books of the Living. Friday, September 10th, 2027. We had another battle to try to sleep through before dawn this morning. It began to the south of us, out on or near the highway, and worked its way first toward, then away from us. We could hear people shooting, screaming, cursing, running. Same old stuff. Tiresome, dangerous, and stupid. The shooting went on for over an hour, waxing and waning. There was a final barrage that seemed to involve more guns than ever. Then the noise stopped. I managed to sleep through some of it. I got over being afraid, even got over being angry. In the end, I was only tired. I thought, if the bastards are going to kill me, I can't stop them by staying awake. If that wasn't altogether true, I didn't care. I slept. And somehow, during or after the battle, in spite of the watch, two people slipped into our camp and bedded down among us. They slept too. We awoke early, as usual, so that we could start walking while the heat wasn't too terrible. We've learned to wake up without prompting at the first light of dawn. Today, four of us sat up in our bags at almost the same time. I was crawling out of my bag to go off and urinate when I spotted the extra people. Two gray lumps in the dawn light, one large and one small, lying against each other, asleep on the bare ground. Thin arms and legs extended like sticks from rags and mounds of clothing. I glanced around at the others and saw that they were staring where I was staring, all of them except Jill, who was supposed to be on watch. We began trusting her to stand night watch last week with a partner. This was only her second solitary watch, and where was she looking? Away into the trees. She and I would have to talk. Harry and Travis were already reacting to the figures on the ground. In silence, each man was peeling out of his bag and his underwear and standing up. More fully clothed, I matched them, move for move, and the three of us closed in around the two intruders. The larger of the two awoke all at once, jumped up, darted two or three steps toward Harry, then stopped. It was a woman. We could see her better now. She was brown-skinned, with a lot of long, straight, unkempt black hair. Her coloring was as dark as mine, but she was all planes and angles. A wiry, hawk-faced woman, who could have used a few decent meals and a good scrubbing. She looked like a lot of people we've seen on the road. The second intruder awoke, saw Travis standing nearby in his underwear, and screamed. That got everyone's attention. It was the high, piercing screech of a child. A little girl who looked about seven. She was a tiny, pinched image of the woman. Her mother, or her sister, perhaps. The woman ran back to the child and tried to scoop her up, but the child had folded herself into a tight, fetal knot, and the woman, trying to lift her, could not get a grip. She stumbled, fell over, and in an instant she, too, had rolled herself into a tight ball. By then, everyone had come to see. "Harry," I said, and waited until he looked at me. "Would you and Zara keep watch? Make sure nothing else surprises us." He nodded. He and Zara detached from the cluster, separated, and took up positions on opposite sides of the camp. Harry, nearest to the approach from the highway, and Zara on the approach from the nearest lesser road. We had buried ourselves as well as we could in a deserted area that Bancole said must once have been a park. But we didn't kid ourselves that we were alone. We'd followed I-5 to a small city outside Sacramento, away from the worst of the sprawl. But there were still plenty of poor people around, local paupers and refugees like us. Where had this pair of ragged, terrified, filthy people come from? "We won't hurt you," I said to them as they lay still rolled up on the ground. "Get up. Come on, get up. You've come into our camp unasked. You can at least talk to us." We didn't touch them. Bancole seemed to want to, but he stopped when I grasped his arm. They were already scared to death. A strange man reaching out to them might make them hysterical. Trembling, the woman unrolled herself and gazed up at us. Now I realized she looked Asian except for her coloring. She put her head down and whispered something to the child. After a moment, the two of them stood up. "We didn't know this was your place," she whispered. "We'll go away. Let us go away."
I sighed and looked at the terrified face of the little girl.
You can go, I said, or if you like, you can eat with us.
They both wanted to run away. They were like deer, frozen in terror, about to bolt. But I'd said the magic word. 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't have said it. But I said today to these two starved-looking people, eat.
Food?
The woman whispered. Yes, we'll share a little food with you. The woman looked at the little girl. I was certain now that they were mother and daughter.
We can't pay, she said. We don't have anything.
I could see that.
Just take what we give you, and nothing more than we give you, I said. That will be pay enough. We won't steal. We aren't thieves.
Of course they were thieves. How else could they live? Some stealing and scavenging, maybe some whoring. They weren't very good at it, or they'd look better. But for the little kid's sake, I wanted to help them at least with a meal.
Wait, then, I said. We'll put a meal together.
They sat where they were and watched us with hungry, hungry eyes. There was more hunger in those eyes than we could fill with all our food. I thought I had probably made a mistake. These people were so desperate, they were dangerous. It didn't matter at all that they looked harmless. They were still alive and strong enough to run. They were not harmless. It was Justin who eased some of the tension in those bottomless, hungry eyes. Stark naked, he toddled over to the woman and the girl and looked them over. The little girl only stared back, but after a moment, the woman began to smile. She said something to Justin, and he smiled. Then he ran back to Allie, who held on to him long enough to dress him. But he had done his work. The woman was seeing us with different eyes. She watched Natividad nursing Dominique, then watched Bancole combing his beard. This seemed funny to her and to the child, and they both giggled.
You're a hit, I told Bancole.
I don't see what's so funny about a man combing his beard, he muttered, and put away his comb.
I dug sweet pears out of my pack and took one each to the woman and the girl. I had just bought them 2 days before, and I had only three left. Other people got the idea and began sharing what they could spare. Shelled walnuts, apples, a pomegranate, Valencia oranges, figs, little things.
Save what you can, Natividad told the woman as she gave her almonds wrapped in a piece of red cloth.
Wrap things in here and tie the ends together. We all shared cornbread, made with a little honey, and the hard-boiled eggs we bought and cooked yesterday. We baked the cornbread in the coals of last night's fire so that we could get away early this morning. The woman and the girl ate as though the plain, cold food were the best they had ever tasted, as though they couldn't believe someone had given it to them. They crouched over it, as though they were afraid we might snatch it back.
We've got to go, I said at last. The sun's getting hotter.
The woman looked at me, her strange, sharp face hungry again, but now not hungry for food.
Let us go with you, she said, her words tumbling over one another. We'll work. We'll get wood, make fire, clean dishes, anything. Take us with you.
Bancole looked at me. I assume you saw that coming. I nodded. The woman was looking from one of us to the other.
Anything, she whispered, or whimpered.
Her eyes were dry and starved, but tears streamed down from the little girl's eyes.
Give us a moment to decide, I said.
I meant go away so my friends can yell at me in private, but the woman didn't seem to understand. She didn't move.
Wait over there, I said, pointing toward the trees nearest the road. Let us talk. Then we'll tell you.
She didn't want to do it. She hesitated, then stood up, pulled her even more reluctant daughter up,
and trudged off to the trees I had indicated.
"Oh, God," Zara muttered. "We're going to take them, aren't we?"
"That's what we have to decide," I said.
"What? We feed her, and then we get to tell her to go away and finish starving?"
Zara made a noise of disgust.
"If she isn't a thief," Benkole said, "and if she doesn't have any other dangerous habits, we may be able to carry them. That little kid..."
"Yes," I said. "Benkole, is there room for them at your place?"
"His place?"
three others asked. I hadn't had a chance to tell them about it, and I hadn't had the nerve.
"He has a lot of land up north, and over by the coast," I said. "There's a family house that we can't live in, because his sister and her family are there, but there's room, and trees, and water. He says..."
I swallowed, looked at Benkole, who was smiling a little.
"He says we can start Earthseed there. Build what we can."
"Are there jobs?" Harry asked Benkole.
"My brother-in-law manages with year-round gardens and temporary jobs. He's raising three kids that way. But the jobs do pay money."
"Yes, they pay.
Not well, but they pay. We'd better hold off talking about this for a while. We're torturing that young woman over there."
"She'll steal," Natividad said. "She says she won't, but she will. You can look at her and tell."
"She's been beaten," Jill said. "The way they rolled up when we first spotted them, they're used to being beaten, kicked, knocked around."
"Yeah." Allie looked haunted. "You tried to keep from getting hit in the head, tried to protect your eyes and your front. She thought we would beat her. She and the kid both."
Interesting that Allie and Jill should understand so well. What a terrible father they had. And what had happened to their mother? They had never talked about her. It was amazing that they had escaped alive and sane enough to function.
"Should we let her stay?" I asked them.
Both girls nodded.
"I think she'll be a pain in the ass for a while, though," Allie said. "Like Natividad said, she'll steal. She won't be able to stop herself. We'll have to watch her real good. The little kid will steal, too. Steal and run like hell."
Zara grinned.
"Reminds me of me at that age. They'll both be pains in the ass. I vote we try them. If they have manners, or if they can learn manners, we keep them. If they're too stupid to learn, we throw them out."
I looked at Travis and Harry standing together. "What do you guys say?"
"I say you're going soft," Harry said. "You would have raised hell if we'd tried to take in a beggar woman and her child a few weeks ago."
I nodded. "You're right. I would have. And maybe that's the attitude we should keep. But these two, I think they might be worth something. And I don't think they're dangerous. If I'm wrong, we can always dump them."
"They might not take to being dumped," Travis said.
Then he shrugged.
"I don't want to be the one to send that little kid out to be one more thief, beggar, whore. But think, Lauren. If we let them stay, and it doesn't work out, it might be damn hard to get rid of them. And if they turn out to have friends around here, friends that they're scouting for, we might have to kill them."
Both Harry and Natividad began to protest. "Kill a woman and a child? No, not possible, never." The rest of us let them talk. When they ran down, I said, "It could get that bad, I suppose, but I don't think it will. That woman wants to live. Even more, she wants the kid to live. I think she'd put up with a lot for the kid's sake, and I don't think she'd put the kid in danger by scouting for a gang. Gangs are more direct out here, anyway. They don't need scouts." Silence.
Shall we try them? I asked. Or shall we turn them away now?
I'm not against them, Travis said. Let them stay, for the kid's sake. But let's go back to having two watchers at once during the night. How the hell did those two get in here like that anyway?
Jill shrank a little. They could have gotten in any time last night, she said. Any time.
What we don't see can kill us, I said. Jill, you didn't see them?
They could have been there when I took over the watch.
You still didn't see them. They could have cut your throat. Or your sister's.
Well, they didn't.
The next one might. I leaned toward her. The world is full of crazy, dangerous people. We see signs of that every day. If we don't watch out for ourselves, they'll rob us, kill us, and maybe eat us. It's a world gone to hell, Jill, and we've only got each other to keep it off us. Sullen silence. I reached out and took her hand. Jill.
It wasn't my fault, she said. You can't prove I...
Jill. She shut up and stared at me. Listen. No one is going to beat you up, for heaven's sake. But you did something wrong, something dangerous. You know you did.
So what do you want her to do? Allie demanded. Get on her knees and say she's sorry?
I want her to love her own life and yours enough not to be careless. That's what I want.
That's what you should want, now more than ever.
Jill? Jill closed her eyes.
Oh, shit, she said. And then, all right, all right. I didn't see them. I really didn't. I'll watch better. No one else will get by me.
I clasped her hand for a moment longer, then let it go.
Okay. Let's get out of here. Let's collect that scared woman and her scared little kid and get out of here.
The two scared people turned out to be the most racially mixed that I had ever met. Here's their story, put together from the fragments they told us during the day and tonight. The woman had a Japanese father, a black mother, and a Mexican husband, all dead. Only she and her daughter are left. Her name is Emery Tanaka Solis. Her daughter is Tori Solis. Tori is 9 years old. Not seven, as I had guessed. I suspect she has rarely had enough to eat in her life. She's tiny, quick, quiet, and hungry-eyed. She hid bits of food in her filthy rags until we made her a new dress from one of Bancole's shirts. Then she hid food in that. Although Tori is 9, her mother is only 23. At 13, Emery married a much older man who promised to take care of her. Her father was already dead, killed in someone else's gunfight. Her mother was sick and dying of tuberculosis. The mother pushed Emery into marriage to save her from victimization and starvation in the streets. Up to that point, the situation was dreary but normal. Emery had 3 children over the next 3 years, a daughter and 2 sons. She and her husband did farm work and trade for food, shelter, and hand-me-downs. Then the farm was sold to a big agribusiness conglomerate, and the workers fell into new hands. Wages were paid, but in company scrip, not in cash. Rent was charged for the workers' shacks. Workers had to pay for food, for clothing, new or used, for everything they needed, and, of course, they could only spend their company notes at the company store. Wages, surprise, were never quite enough to pay the bills. According to new laws that might or might not exist, people were not permitted to leave an employer to whom they owed money. They were obliged to work off the debt either as quasi-indentured people or as convicts. That is, if they refused to work, they could be arrested, jailed, and in the end, handed over to their employers. Either way, such debt slaves could be forced to work longer hours for less pay, could be disciplined if they failed to meet their quotas, could be traded and sold with or without their consent, with or without their families, to distant employers
who had temporary or permanent need of them. Worse, children could be forced to work off the debt of their parents if the parents died, became disabled, or escaped. Emery's husband sickened and died. There was no doctor, no medicine beyond a few expensive over-the-counter preparations and the herbs that the workers grew in their tiny gardens. Jorge Francisco Solis died in fever and pain on the earthen floor of his shack without ever seeing a doctor. Bancole said it sounded as though he died of peritonitis, brought on by untreated appendicitis. Such a simple thing, but then there's nothing more replaceable than unskilled labor. Emery and her children became responsible for the Solis debt. Accepting this, Emery worked and endured until one day, without warning, her sons were taken away. They were 1 and 2 years younger than her daughter and too young to be without both their parents, yet they were taken. Emery was not asked to part with them, nor was she told what would be done with them. She had terrible suspicions when she recovered from the drug she'd been given to quiet her down. She cried and demanded the return of her sons, and would not work again until her masters threatened to take her daughter as well. She decided then to run away, to take her daughter and brave the roads with their thieves, rapists, and cannibals. They had nothing for anyone to steal, and rape wasn't something they could escape by remaining slaves. As for the cannibals, well, perhaps they were only fantasies, lies intended to frighten slaves into accepting their lot. "There are cannibals," I told her as we ate that night. "We've seen them. I think, though, that they're scavengers, not killers. They take advantage of road kills, that kind of thing." "Scavengers kill," Emery said. "If you get hurt, or if you look sick, they come after you." I nodded, and she went on with her story. Late one night, she and Tori slipped out past the armed guards and electrified fences, the sound and motion detectors, and the dogs. Both knew how to be quiet, how to fade from cover to cover, how to lie still for hours. Both were very fast. Slaves learned things like that. The ones who lived did. Emery and Tori must have been very lucky. Emery had some notion of finding her sons and getting them back, but she had no idea where they had been taken. They had been driven away in a truck, she knew that much. But she didn't know even which way the truck turned when it reached the highway. Her parents had taught her to read and write, but she had seen no writing about her son. She had to admit, after a while, that all she could do was save her daughter. Living on wild plants and whatever they could find or beg, they drifted north. That was the way Emery said it. They found things. Well, if I were in her place, I would have found a few things, too. A gang fight drove her to us. Gangs are always a special danger in cities. If you keep to the road while you're in individual gang territory, you might escape their attentions. We have so far. But the overgrown parkland where we camped last night was, according to Emery, in dispute. Two gangs shot at each other and called insults and accusations back and forth. Now and then they stopped to shoot at passing trucks. During one of these intervals, Emery and Tori, who had camped close to the roadside, had slipped away. "One group was coming closer to us," Emery said. "They would shoot and run. When they ran, they got closer. We had to get away. We couldn't let them hear us or see us. We found your clearing, but we didn't see you. You know how to hide." That, I suppose, was a compliment. We try to disappear into the scenery when that's possible. Most of the time, it isn't. Tonight, it isn't. And tonight, we watch two at a time. Sunday, September 12th, 2027. Tori Solis has found us two more companions today. Grayson Mora and his daughter Doe.
Doe was only a year younger than Tori, and the two little girls, walking along, going the same way, became friends. Today, we turned west on State Highway 20, and we're heading back toward U.S. 101. We spent a lot of time talking about settling on Bankole's land, about jobs and crops, and what we might build there. Meanwhile, the two little girls, Tori and Doe, were making friends and pulling their parents together. The parents were alike enough to attract my attention. They were about the same age, which meant that the man had become a father almost as young as the woman had become a mother. That wasn't unusual, but it was unusual that he had taken charge of his child. He was a tall, thin, black Latino, quiet, protective of his child, yet tentative somehow. He liked Emery, I could see that. Yet on some level he wanted to get away from her, and away from us. When we left the road to make camp, he would have gone on if his daughter had not begged, then cried, to stay with us. He had his own food, so we told him he could camp near us if he wanted to. Two things hit me as I talked to him. First, he didn't like us. That was obvious. He didn't like us at all. I thought he might resent us, because we were united and armed. You tend to resent the people you're afraid of. I told him we kept a watch, and that if he could put up with that, he was welcome. He shrugged and said in his soft, cold voice, "Oh, yeah. He'll stay. His kid wants it, and some part of him wants it. But something's wrong. Something beyond ordinary traveler caution. The second thing is only my suspicion. I believe Grayson and Doe Mora were also slaves. Yet Grayson is now a rich pauper. He has a pair of sleep sacks, food, water, and money. And if I'm right, he took them off someone, or off someone's corpse. Why do I think he was a slave? That odd tentativeness of his is just too much like Emery's. And Doe and Tori, though they don't look alike at all, seem to understand each other like sisters. Little kids can do that sometimes without it meaning anything. Just being little kids together is enough. But I've never seen any kids but these two. Both show the tendency to drop to the ground and roll into a fetal knot when frightened. Doe did just that when she tripped and fell, and Zara stepped over to see whether she was hurt. Doe's body snapped into a trembling ball. Was that, as Jill and Allie supposed, what people did when they expected to be beaten or kicked? A posture of protection and submission both at once? "Something's wrong with that fellow," Bankole said, glancing at Grayson as we bedded down next to each other. We had eaten and heard more of Emery's story and talked a little, but we were tired. I had my writing to do, and Travis and Jill were on watch. Bankole, who had an early morning watch with Zara, just wanted to talk. He sat beside me and spoke into my ear in a voice so low that if I leaned away from him, I lost words. "Mora's too jumpy," he said. "He flinches if someone walks near him." "I think he's another ex-slave," I said in a voice just as low. "That might not be his only problem, but it's his most obvious one." "So you picked up on that, too." He put his arm around me and sighed. "I agree. Both he and the child." "And he doesn't love us." "He doesn't trust us. Why should he? We'll have to watch all four of them for a while. They're odd. They might be stupid enough to try to grab some of our packs and leave some night. Or it might just be a matter of little things starting to disappear. The children are more likely to get caught at it. Yet if the adults stay, it will be for the children's sake. If we take it easy on the children and protect them, I think the adults will be loyal to us. So, we become the crew of a modern underground railroad," I said. "Slavery again. even worse than my father thought, or at least sooner. He thought it would take a while.
None of this is new. Bancoli made himself comfortable against me. In the early 1990s, when I was in college, I heard about cases of growers doing some of this, holding people against their wills and forcing them to work without pay. Latins in California, blacks and Latins in the South. Now and then, someone would go to jail for it.
But Emery says there's a new law, that forcing people or their children to work off debt that they can't help running up is legal.
Maybe. It's hard to know what to believe. I suppose the politicians may have passed a law that could be used to support debt slavery, but I've heard nothing about it. Anyone dirty enough to be a slaver is dirty enough to tell a pack of lies. You realize that that woman's children were sold like cattle, and no doubt sold into prostitution.
I nodded. She knows, too.
Yes. My God.
Things are breaking down more and more. I paused. I'll tell you, though. If we can convince ex-slaves that they can have freedom with us, no one will fight harder to keep it. We need better guns, though. And we need to be so careful. It keeps getting more dangerous out here. It will be especially dangerous with those little girls around.
Those two know how to be quiet, Bancoli said. They're little rabbits, fast and silent. That's why they're still alive.
Chapter 24. Respect God. Pray working, pray learning, planning, doing. Pray creating, teaching, reaching. Pray working. Pray to focus your thoughts, still your fears, strengthen your purpose. Respect God. Shape God. Pray working. Earthseed, The Books of the Living. Friday, September 17th, 2027. We read some verses and talked about Earthseed for a while this morning. It was a calming thing to do, almost like church. We needed something calming and reassuring. Even the new people joined in, asking questions, thinking aloud, applying the verses to their experiences. God is change, and in the end, God does prevail. But we have something to say about the wins and the whys of that end. Yeah. It's been a horrible week. We've taken both today and yesterday as rest days. We might take tomorrow as well. I need it, whether the others do or not. We're all sore and sick, in mourning and exhausted, yet triumphant. Odd to be triumphant. I think it's because most of us are still alive. We are a harvest of survivors, but then, that's what we've always been. This is what happened. At our noon stop on Tuesday, Tori and Doe, the two little girls, went away from the group to urinate. Emery went with them. She had kind of taken charge of Doe as well as her own daughter. The night before, she and Grace and Mora had slipped away from the group and stayed away for over an hour. Harry and I were on watch and we saw them go. Now they were a couple, all over each other, but at arm's length from everyone else. Strange people. So, Emery took the girls off to pee, not far away, just across the hill face and out of sight behind a patch of dead bushes and tall, dry grass. The rest of us sat eating, drinking, and sweating in what shade we could get from a copse of oak trees that looked only half dead. The trees had been robbed of a great number of branches, no doubt by people needing firewood. I was looking at their many jagged wounds when the screaming began. First, there was a high, needle-thin, needle-sharp screeches of the little girls. Then we heard Emery shouting for help. Then we heard a man's voice cursing.
Most of us jumped up without thinking and ran toward the noise. In mid-stride, I grabbed Harry and Zara by the arms to get their attention. Then I gestured them back to guard our packs, Natividad and Allie, who had stayed with the babies. Harry had the rifle, and Zara had one of the Berettas, and in that moment they both resented the hell out of me. No matter. For the moment, I was just glad to see them go back. They could cover us, if necessary, and keep us from being overwhelmed. I found Emery fighting with a big, bald man who had grabbed Tori. Doe was already running back to us, screaming. She ran straight into her father's arms. He swept her up and ran off toward the highway. Then he veered back toward the oaks and our people. There were other bald people coming up from the highway. Like us, they ran toward the screams. I saw metal gleaming among them, perhaps only knives, perhaps guns. Travis spotted the group, too, and yelled a warning before I could. I fell back, dropped to one knee, aimed my .45 two-handed, and waited for a clear shot at Emery's attacker. The man was much taller than Emery, and his head and shoulders were exposed, except where he held Tori against him. The little girl looked like a doll that he was clutching in one arm. Emery was the problem. She, small and quick, was darting at the man, tearing at his face, trying to reach his eyes. He was trying to protect his eyes and to knock her or throw her away from him. With both hands free, he might have been quick enough to bat her aside, but he wouldn't let go of the struggling Tori, and Emery wouldn't be beaten off. For an instant, he did knock Emery back from him. In that brief window of time, my own ears ringing from his blow, I shot him. I knew at once that I'd hit him. He didn't fall, but I felt his pain, and I wasn't good for anything else for a while. Then he toppled, and I collapsed with him. But I could still see and hear, and I still had the gun. I heard shouting. The bald gang from the highway was almost on us. 6, 7, 8 people. I couldn't do anything while I was dealing with the pain, but I saw them. Instants later, when the man I had shot lost consciousness or died, I was free. And needed. Bencole had our only other gun away from the camp. I got up before I should have, almost fell down again, and then shot a second attacker off Travis, who was carrying Emery. I went down again, but didn't lose consciousness. I saw Bencole grab Tori and all but throw her to Jill. Jill caught her, turned, and ran back toward camp with her. Bencole reached me, and I was able to get up and help him cover our retreat. We had only the scarred trees to retreat to, but they had thick, solid-looking trunks. An attacker fired several bullets into them as we reached them. It took me several seconds to understand that someone was shooting at us. Once I did, I dropped behind the trees with the others and looked for the opposing gun. Our rifle thundered behind me before I could spot anything. Harry, on the job. He fired twice more. I fired twice myself, barely aiming, barely in control. I believe Bencole fired. Then I was lost. No more good for anything. I died with someone. The shooting stopped. I died with someone else. Someone laid hands on me, and I came within a finger's twitch of squeezing the trigger once more. Bencole.
You stupid asshole, I whimpered. I almost killed you.
You're bleeding, he said. I was surprised. I tried to remember whether I'd been shot. Maybe I had just come down on a sharp piece of wood. I had no sense of my own body. I hurt, but I couldn't have said where, or even whether the pain was mine or someone else's. The pain was intense, yet diffused somehow. I felt disembodied. Is everyone else all right? I asked.
Be still, he said.
Is it over, Bencole?
Yes. The survivors have run away.
take my gun, then, and give it to Natividad, in case they decide to come back. I think I felt him take the gun from my hand. I heard muffled talk that I didn't quite understand. That was when I realized I was losing consciousness. All right, then. At least I had held on long enough to do some good. Jill Gilchrist is dead. She was shot in the back as she ran toward the trees carrying Tori. Bencole didn't tell me, didn't want me to know before I had to, because, as it turned out, I was wounded myself. I was lucky. My wound was minor. It hurt. But other than that, it didn't matter much. Jill was unlucky. I found out about her death when I came to, and heard Allie's hoarse screaming grief. Jill had gotten Tori back to the trees, put her down, and then without a sound, folded to the ground, as though taking cover. Emery had grabbed Tori and huddled, crying with her in terror and relief. Everyone else had been busy, first taking cover, then firing or directing fire. Travis was the first to see the blood pooling around Jill. He shouted for Pencole, then turned Jill onto her back and saw blood welling from what turned out to be an exit wound in her chest. Pencole says she died before he reached her. No last words, no last sight of her sister, not even the assurance that she had saved the little girl. She had. Tori was bruised, but fine. Everyone was fine, except Jill. My own wound, to be honest, was a big scratch. The bullet had plowed a furrow straight through the flesh of my left side, leaving little damage, a lot of blood, a couple of holes in my shirt, and a lot of pain. The wound throbbed worse than a burn, but it wasn't disabling. "Cowboy wound," Harry said, when he and Zara came to look me over. They both looked dirty and miserable, but Harry tried to be upbeat for me. They had just helped to bury Jill. The group had, with hands, sticks, and out hatchet, dug a shallow grave for her while I was unconscious. They put her among the tree roots, covered her, and rolled big rocks atop her grave. The trees were to have her, but the dogs and the cannibals were not. The group had decided to bed down for the night where we were, even though our oak copse should have been rejected as an overnight camp because it was too close to the highway. "You're a goddamn fool and too big to carry," Zara told me, "so just rest there and let Bencole take care of you. Not that anyone could stop him." "You've just got a cowboy wound," Harry repeated. "In that book I bought, people are always getting shot in the side or the arm or the shoulder, and it's nothing. Although Pencole says a good percentage of them would have died of tetanus or some other infection." "Thanks for the encouragement," I said. Zara gave him a look, then patted my arm. "Don't worry," she said. "No germ will get past that old man. He's as mad as hell at you for getting yourself shot. Says if you had any sense, you would have stayed back here with the babies." "What?" "Hey, he's old," Harry said. "What do you expect?" I sighed. "How's Allie?" "Crying." He shook his head. "She won't let anyone near her except Justin. Even he keeps trying to comfort her. It upsets him that she's crying." "Emery and Tori are kind of beaten up, too," Zara said. "They're the other reason we're not moving." She paused. "Hey, Lauren, you ever notice anything funny about those two? Emery and Tori, I mean? And about that guy Mora, too?" Something clicked into place for me, and I sighed again. "They're sharers, aren't they?" "Yes. All of them. Both adults and both kids. You knew?" Not until now. I did notice something odd. That tentativeness and touchiness. Not wanting to be touched, I mean. And they were all slaves. My brother Marcus once said what good slaves sharers would make. That Mora guy wants to leave, Harry said. So let him go, I answered. He tried to run out on us just before the shooting. He came back. He even helped dig Jill's grave. I mean, he wants us all to leave. He says that gang we beat up will come back when it's dark.
He's sure?
Yeah. He's going crazy, wanting to get his kid out of here.
Can Emery and Tori make it?
I'll carry Tori, a new voice said. Emery can make it. Grace and Mora, of course, last seen abandoning ship. I got up slowly. My side hurt. Bancole had cleaned and bandaged the wound while I was unconscious, and it was a bit of luck. Now, though, I felt half-conscious, half-detached from my body. I felt everything except pain, as though through a thick layer of cotton. Only the pain was sharp and real. I was almost grateful for it. I can walk, I said after trying a few steps. But I feel like I'm walking on stilts. I don't know if I can keep the usual pace. Grace and Mara stepped close to me. He glanced at Harry as though he wished Harry would go away. Harry just stared back at him.
How many times did you die? Mara asked me.
Three, at least, I answered as though this were a sane conversation. Maybe four. I never did it like that before, over and over. It's insane. But you look well enough. His expression hardened, as though I'd slapped him. Of course, I had insulted him. I'd said, "Where were you, man, and fellow sharer, while your woman and your group were in danger?" Funny, there I was speaking a language I hadn't realized I knew. "I had to get Doe out of danger," he said. "I had no gun anyway." "Can you shoot?" He hesitated. "Never shot before," he admitted, dropping his voice to a mumble. Again, I'd shamed him, this time without meaning to. "When we teach you to shoot, will you? To protect the group?"
"Yeah."
Though at that moment I think he would have preferred to shoot me. "It hurts like hell," I warned. He shrugged. "Most things do." I looked into his thin, angry face. Were all slaves so thin, underfed, overworked, and taught that most things hurt? "Are you from this area?"
"Born in Sacramento."
"Then we need all the information you can give us. Even without a gun, we need you to help us survive here."
"My information is to get out of here before those things up the hill throw paint on themselves and start shooting people and setting fires."
"Oh, shit," I said. "So that's what they are."
"What'd you think they were?"
I didn't have a chance to think about them. It wouldn't have mattered anyway. "Harry, did you guys strip the dead?"
"Yeah."
He gave me a thin smile. "We got another gun, a 38. I put some stuff in your pack from the ones you killed."
"Thank you.
I don't know that I can carry my pack yet. Maybe Bancole, he's already got it on his cart.
Let's go."
We headed out toward the road.
"Is that how you do it?" Grace and Mara asked, walking next to me. "Whoever kills takes?"
"Yes."
"But we don't kill unless someone threatens us," I said. "We don't hunt people. We don't eat human flesh. We fight together against enemies. If one of us is in need, the rest help out. And we don't steal from one another. Ever."
Emery said that. I didn't believe her at first.
"Will you live as we do?"
Yeah, I guess so. I hesitated. So what else is wrong? I can see that you don't trust us even now. He walked closer to me, but didn't touch me. Where'd that white man come from? He demanded. I've known him all my life, I said. He and I and the others have kept one another alive for a long time now. But him and those others, they don't feel anything. You're the only one who feels. We call it sharing. I'm the only one. But they, you, we help each other. A group is strong. One or two people are easier to rob and kill. Yeah. He looked around at the others. There was no great trust or liking in his expression, but he looked more relaxed, more satisfied. He looked as though he had solved a troubling puzzle. Testing him, I let myself stumble. It was easy. I still had little feeling in my feet and legs. Mora stepped aside. He didn't touch me or offer help. Sweet guy. I left Mora, went over to Allie, and walked with her for a while. Her grief and resentment were like a wall against me, against everyone, I suppose, but I was the one bothering her at the moment. And I was alive, and her sister was dead. And her sister was the only family she had left, and why didn't I just get the hell out of her face? She never said anything. She just pretended I wasn't there. She pushed Justin along in his carriage and wiped tears from her stony face now and then with a swift, whip-like motion. She was hurting herself doing that. She was rubbing her face too hard, too fast, rubbing it raw. She was hurting me too, and I didn't need any more pain. I stayed with her, though, until her defenses began to crumble under a new wave of crippling grief. She stopped hurting herself and just let the tears run down her face, let them fall to her chest or to the broken blacktop. She seemed to sag under a sudden weight. I hugged her then. I put my hands on her shoulders and stopped her half-blind plodding. When she swung around to face me, hostile and hurting, I hugged her. She could have broken free. I was feeling far from strong just then, but after a first angry pulling away, she hung on to me and moaned. I've never heard anyone moan like that. She cried and moaned there at the roadside, and the others stopped and waited for us. No one spoke. Justin began to whimper, and Natividad came back to comfort him. The wordless message was the same for both child and woman. In spite of your loss and pain, you aren't alone. You still have people who care about you and want you to be all right. You still have family. After a while, Allie and I let each other go. She isn't a chatty woman, especially not in her pain. She took Justin from Natividad, smoothed his hair, and held him. When we began walking again, she carried him for a while, and I pushed the carriage. We walked together, and there didn't seem to be any need to say anything. On the road, there was a fair amount of foot traffic in both directions. Still, I worried that a big group like ours would be noticeable and locatable, no matter what. I worried because I didn't understand the ways of our attackers. Sometime later, when Allie put Justin back into the carriage and took the carriage from me, I moved to walk with Bankole and Emery. Emery was the one who explained things to me, and she was the one who spotted the smoke from the first fire, no doubt because she was looking for it. We couldn't tell for sure, but the fire looked as though it might have begun back as far as where we had stopped at the oak copse. They'll burn everything, Emery whispered to Bankole and me. They won't stop,
until they've used up all the row they have. All night, they'll be burning things, things and people. Row, pyro, pyromania, that damn fire drug again. Will they?